Acts chapter 13 and verse 22, if you remember from last week, tells us that he raised up David to be their king, concerning whom he also testified and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my heart, who will do all my will. And as I pointed out in the last week, a part of being a man after the heart of Yahweh is to be a man or a woman who intends to do all the will of Yahweh, as he would have it to be in our lives. This will be a man after Yahweh's own heart, part 13. Not only David, but Lord willing, you and I as well, men and women after the heart of Yahweh. We left off in the previous message with 1 Samuel chapter 25. Let's just jump right into this and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 26. And Lord willing, believe it or not, I intend, instead of only getting through a few verses, to get through three chapters. So if we do this kind of quickly, bear with me. And if you're not at a passage when I'm there, you can just listen to it. 1 Samuel chapter 26, chapter 25. And we won't be spending a whole lot of time in this chapter. We won't be reading the whole thing. But it is interesting that immediately following the incident in 1 Samuel chapter 24, if you'll remember, where David displayed almost a supernatural humility and restraint in refusing to take revenge upon Saul into his own hands, it's interesting that following right on the heels of that amazing episode in chapter 24, we have this incident narrated in 1 Samuel chapter 25, where David, if he had not been confronted and, if you will, checked by Abigail, he would have taken personal vengeance into his own hands upon Abigail's husband, who was named Nabal, as well as his servants. Now, if you're unfamiliar with this account, you can read it for yourself. But in short, while David abode in the wilderness of Paran, if you will, making one more lap around, quote-unquote, Mount Sinai to learn what it was that Yahweh wanted him to learn, while abiding in the Paran wilderness, he and his men at that time, during this time, guarded both the servants and the livestock of a wealthy landowner named Nabal. And neither did they help themselves. They were out there protecting them from marauding bands of thieves and possibly murderers. And they protected his men and his livestock from any loss. And neither did they help themselves to what belonged to Nabal as well. And in the process of time, David sends 10 of his young men to ask provision. He didn't just help himself to it, but he sends 10 of his young men in light of what he'd been doing for Nabal and Nabal's property. He sends 10 of his young men to ask for provisions of Nabal for he and his men, to which Nabal essentially responded, if you're familiar with the story, with, go take a fly and leave, buddy, or whatever the idiom would have been, a similar idiom of that day. Now, that's Ted's paraphrase of that. That's not what you're going to find in there. But that's essentially what he told David, was go take a fly and leave. And in this instance, David had his men arm themselves and prepare themselves not to go and cut off simply the end of Nabal's robe, but to go cut his head off. And a person, you know, you get to thinking about this whole story and the years and what's been happening to David through all of this. A person can almost empathize with David in this situation. After all, it was bad enough that it was bad enough being on the run from Saul and having to humiliate himself before Saul and his own men and Saul's men as he did in the previous chapter. And now he's once again, after all of that, after doing what he did, going beyond what any man would even probably consider doing, now he's once again out running around another wilderness, tired and hungry, I'm sure, and obviously hungry because he's asking for provisions. Probably more than, at the same time, probably more than just a little disappointed that Yahweh hasn't rewarded his good deed a little bit more quickly. And I think he had just, at that point, flat run out of patience. Especially with the likes of Nabal, who, even as his wife testified, his very name meant foolishness and worthless. And so he flat run out of patience. In other words, David was human after all. And I don't know about you, but I'm not so sure, and I'm not really excited about confessing this, but I'm not so sure that I don't relate more with David in this chapter than I do in the previous one. Let's go give that worthless guy what he deserves. Isn't that the attitude? You know, somebody does us, and man, let's go get him. He deserves it. And again, I confess, there's at least times in my life I think I relate better with David here than otherwise. But thank God and praise Yahweh for the Abigails that he sometimes sends into our lives to restrain us from our own foolishness. Maybe we would sometimes be best named Nabal. And what would sometimes otherwise even be iniquity in our lives? Thank God for the Abigails, if you've had them in your lives, as I've had sometimes in mine. Let's pick this story up. I don't want to not read any of it, but let's pick it up in 1 Samuel chapter 25 and verse 18. We're going to kind of skip through this. Verse 18, then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 bottles of wine. I never caught this before, but I don't know how 2 bottles of wives compare with 200 loaves of bread. But anyway, the bottles would have got heavy. Skins. Oh, that made it a little bit lighter, and that's probably more correct. You bet, back then. And 5 sheep ready dressed, and 5 measures of parched corn, and 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and laid them on the asses. Now, I should have mentioned that this is after Nabal has said, go take a flying leap. I'm not about to have anything to do with you. And she overhears from one of the servants that this is what Nabal has done, and now she's coming to David's aid. Verse 19, and she said unto her servants, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she told not her husband Nabal. And it was so, as she rode on the ass, that she came down by the covert of the hill, and behold, David and his men came down against her, and she met them. Jump down over to verse 23. And when Abigail saw David, she hasted and lighted off the ass, and fell before David on her face, and bowed herself to the ground, and fell at his feet, and said, upon me, my lord, upon me let this iniquity be, and let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience, and hear the words of thy handmaid. Let not my lord, I pray thee. Now listen to where she goes with this. That she didn't come imploring for her husband. She came imploring for David. Verse 25, let not my lord, I pray thee, regard this man of Belial, even Nabal, for as his name is, so he is. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, thy handmaid, saw not the young men of my lord, whom thou didst send. Now therefore, my lord, as Yahweh liveth and as thy soul liveth, seeing Yahweh has withholden thee from coming to shed blood and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, now let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my lord be as Nabal. And again, imploring for David, not her husband in this case. Verse 28, it says, I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thy handmaid, for Yahweh will certainly make my lord a sure house, because my lord fighteth the battles of Yahweh, and evil has not been found in thee all the days. Yet a man, verse 29, yet a man is risen. Let me see where I want to go with this. Verse 29, yet a man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul, speaking of Saul, but the soul of my lord shall be bound in the bundle of life with Yahweh thy God, and the souls of thy enemies, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. And it shall come to pass, when Yahweh shall have done to my lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning thee, and shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel, verse 31, that this shall be no grief unto thee. This act which he was about to do, that she's hopefully going to stop him in, she says, that this shall be no grief unto thee, nor offense of heart unto my lord, either that thou hast shed blood causeless, or that my lord has avenged himself. But when Yahweh shall have dealt well with my lord, then remember thine handmaid. Now, there it was, Abigail's plea to David that he not do this thing that would be a blemish upon his record. Now, David has already armed his men. He's ready to go. He's lathered up, if you will, to go find justice against this Nabal. And so how do you think he responds? Verses 32 through 35. And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be Yahweh God of Israel, which sent thee this day to meet me. And blessed be thy advice, and blessed be thou which has kept me this day from coming to shed blood, and from avenging myself with mine own hand. For in very deed, as Yahweh God of Israel liveth, which has kept me back from hurting thee, except thou hast hasted and come to meet me, surely there had not been left unto Nabal by the morning light any as much as even one man." I didn't read that New King James, but inserted the New American Standard, a little bit more polite in public, mixed company here. But he said, "Thank God, bless you, woman, because I indeed would have had you not come and stopped me in this situation." By the way, and because we're not going to read the rest of this, in case you're not familiar with this account, shortly thereafter, Yahweh deals with Nabal himself, and he dies. And Abigail becomes David's wife. Now, that's the rest of that story. But what's the lesson here? Why go to this account? What's the lesson here? Well, for David, I suspect the lesson was don't be a respecter of persons. Because whereas he was unwilling to take revenge upon a king, Yahweh's anointed, he was all too willing to take revenge upon this lowlife Nabal. And this is all it was. Keep in mind, this wasn't a battle like the one he had with Goliath, where he was defending Yahweh and Yahweh's name and Yahweh's people. This was simply personal revenge. And he was all too willing right now, whether you can empathize with the man or not, because he just simply ran out of patience, it was still ungodly and wicked for him to want to take revenge upon Nabal. And he was therefore a respecter of persons. There was much more reason for him to do so with Saul, if you want to look at reason and the weight of the reason, much more reason to do it to Saul, and yet he wouldn't do it unto Saul, but he was more than willing to do it unto Nabal. But Yahweh's law, of course, is replete with admonitions, with commands, in fact, that we are not to be a respecter of persons as it concerns judgment or the applications of Yahweh's laws or principles as found in His Word. Leviticus 19:15, there's several of them, but Leviticus 19:15, for example, it says, "You shall do no injustice, no inequity in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor," or you could say the lowly, "or defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor," in other words, whoever he is, whatever state in life he may have, "fairly," or evenly, you could say. New Testament application of that is found in James chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. We won't go read that, but in case you'd like to see that. But with that New Testament application, of course, we know the law extends into the New Covenant regardless. But as a result, therefore, a lesson for both David and us as well, right? That we are just as required as David was to show equity in all situations, no matter what state of life someone may be in. The noble or the ignoble are to be treated the same and accorded the same treatment. And aren't you glad that that's the way Yahweh is? I mean, he doesn't provide laws that he himself doesn't keep. Aren't you glad that that's how Yahweh treated us? The ignoble, the base, and the lowly that we are. That he just didn't choose those of high stature in society, but he chose people like you and me. But there's another lesson for us to learn from David in this account as well. Anyone have an idea what it might be? Now, I want you to consider his response to Abigail. Well, a godly man, a man after the heart of Yahweh, is a man who is easily entreated. Which, by the way, and wasn't he easily entreated? It was just like he recognized it immediately. And he said, woman, get out of here. Who are you to come and come to me who's next to be king in Israel? He just immediately saw his sin. Now, he was human. He shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. So you can maybe put a strike on that side against him. But the strike for him is that he immediately responded and was easily entreated, which, by the way, is also one of the seven pillars of godly wisdom. James chapter 3 and verse 17. But the wisdom that from above, excuse me, the wisdom that is from above is pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. The New American Standard, instead of easily to be entreated, translates that word, that Greek word there, as reasonable. Are we reasonable? If you're reasonable, you're going to be easily be entreated. In fact, it footnotes reasonable as willing to yield. Of course, when you see that you're in the wrong. Are you as willing to yield and as quickly as David was? Or do we have to stew about it for a while? Or do we even get there at all is the question. David proved his wisdom in that he was easily entreated. How about us? Are we easily entreated? You say, yeah, I think I'm pretty easily entreated. I'm pretty easy to get along with. Well, men, are you easily entreated by your wives? Oh, don't tell me I gotta be easily entreated by my wife. Or ladies, are you easily entreated by your husband? Now that's starting to get down where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? We start saying, maybe I'm not as easy to get along as I thought I was. Are you easily entreated by your children? Boy, that's a tough one. Talk about have to eat humble pie is when your children are right and you find out you're wrong. Are you easily entreated? Are you easily entreated by your employer? Better be, or you're going to find out you're going to need a new boss pretty quick. But how about fellow employees and other employees that may not be of the same rank or seniority as you? Are you really easily entreated? A man who is not easily entreated is a man who, simply put, has too much pride and thinks too highly of himself. That's all it amounts to. You think about it. That's really what it boils down to. On the other hand, if you have as an attitude or as an approach to life that you're not perfect, maybe real close, but not yet perfect. If you understand, hey, I'm not perfect, and you understand that the only way, and that's one of your goals in life, is to be perfect. Nothing wrong with that, by the way. Doesn't Christ himself say, be holy as I am holy? That's the same as saying, be perfect as I am perfect. That should be a goal in our life. And so if you understand that you're not that, your approach to life is, I'm not there yet. And in most cases, not very close at all. And you understand that the only way for you to become more of what it is that you should and need to be. And by the way, keep in mind that what we're supposed to be, again, is like Christ. That we're supposed to be doing everything we can, doing our best to walk in His footsteps. You talk about the big footsteps of the Father that spread all apart through the sand, and the little boy that's trying to reach his little prince into the, into his father's. It doesn't begin to compare with the prince that Christ has left us. We're supposed to do our best to walk in His footsteps. Bible says being transformed. Now catch this. Sometimes we think that transformation is a one-time thing when we surrender our lives to Christ. Being transformed daily into His image by the renewing of our mind. Romans 12 and verse 2. And in His same image, it says, from glory to glory. God intends us to have a glory different tomorrow than the glory we had today because of the result of following in His footsteps. Now, I don't know about you, and I hate to admit this too, but I don't know that the glory is all that perceptible in my life between yesterday and today. But that's what we should be shooting for, is to be transformed in His glory from glory to glory, as it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18. Furthermore, turn to, real quickly, keep your place there in 1 Samuel, turn to Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, beginning with verse 15, and it says, "And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful." Verse 16 particular, "Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord." Now note there that it says that we're to admonish. We're commanded, we're admonished to admonish one another. And with that in mind, if it is our goal to be transformed daily, if our goal is to reach, at least be reaching for perfection, if that's our goal and approach to life, we'll not only desire, but we'll encourage others to point out the blind spots in our lives that's keeping us from reaching further into perfection. And maybe to point out the ones that aren't so blind, too, sometimes. You know, we better deal with those first, though. But then be expecting, open the door saying, "Hey, brother, I want you to come to me. And I want you to point out." Now, that's easily entreated. That's going even a step further. You know, come to me. How many of you have done that? Said to your brother or your sister, your wife or your husband, said, "I want to know where I'm falling short." That is a description of a man who is easily entreated. Well, of course, if after they tell you, you put up with it. You better put up with it if you're going to ask for it. Not that that's easy. But that is a description of a man, one with such an attitude, or if you have such an attitude, you too will display godly wisdom, and that you likewise will be one who's easily entreated, as was David. Now, before leaving this account, there's something also for the women to learn from Abigail in this account. Actually, it's something not to learn from Abigail, and something that cannot be extracted from this account. I've witnessed women in the past attempt to use Abigail's actions here as a biblical precedent for disobeying an ungodly husband. Sorry, ladies. I know you'd like to have that as an excuse. But sorry, that flies in the face of 1 Peter chapter 3. In fact, keep your place there in Samuel. Let's go back to 1 Peter chapter 3. And let's read this. 1 Peter chapter 3 begins with the word likewise, and therefore you have to go to somewhere in the previous chapter to know what Peter is describing as likewise. Actually, it begins up with about verse 12, I believe, but let's just go back to verse 24 and 25 of chapter 2, where it says, who his own self, verse 21, actually. "For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us as an example that you should follow in his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not," here we go, "but committed himself to him that judges righteously, who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we being dead to sins should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. For ye were as sheep going astray, and are now returned unto the shepherd and the bishop of your souls." And then it says in the next verse, take away the chapter subdivision that wasn't there initially anyway, and it says, "likewise." Just talked about how Christ endured what he endured as a sheep that didn't even bleat when he was slaughtered. And it says, "likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands when they treat you like queens." Your version say that? Doesn't say that. It says, "likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation," or New American Standard has it more clearly for us in this day and generation, "by the behavior of their wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear, whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of the plaiting of the hair and the wearing of gold or the putting on of apparel," that only, But let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which in the sight of God is of great price. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also who trusted in God adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. Now, the point being is that verse 1 makes it pretty clear that as Christ suffered as he did unjustly, women even with a disobedient husband, ye likewise are to be in subjection to such husbands. And therefore, to try to use Abigail's situation flies in the face of 1 Peter chapter 3. What Abigail did was clearly an exception to the general rule for how Yahweh wants godly women to behave even toward ungodly husbands. And therefore, what she did under other circumstances would have been unbiblical and ungodly. So what makes hers an exception? Abigail's actions are a biblical precedent, for disobedience to husbands. It is indeed that. God rewarded this woman for what she did. And therefore, it is a biblical precedent for disobedience to husbands, but only when their lives are at stake. Abigail went behind her husband's back and was therefore disobedient in doing so. But her actions, think about the account, were necessary to save his life and the life of his servants. And therefore, only when lives are at stake can the general rule be set aside, just as it is when it comes to lying, which we've also dealt, if you remember, in this series. If you lie, or if a woman would disobey their husbands to preserve somebody's life, it is not sinful to do so. Otherwise, the general rule provided on lying and on wives' obedience to their husbands is what the Bible demands as the general behavior of wives to husbands. That makes sense? So, I've seen ladies try to use it. It just doesn't fly any more than trying to say that in these other cases where there's biblical lying, righteous lying, that that's a case for lying under all circumstances. It just doesn't fly when you understand the sum of God's word on the subject. All right, enough on 1 Samuel chapter 25. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 26. 1 Samuel chapter 26, beginning with verse 1, and it says, "And the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakkalah, which is before Jeshimon?" By the way, there's got to be something about these Ziphites, because this is the second time that they've betrayed David to Saul. First time, I believe, was in verse chapter 23. All right, continuing verse 2, it says, "Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph." Here we go again. Same song, same verse, all over again. Verses 3 through 5. "And Saul pitched in the hill of Hakkalah, which is before Jeshimon by the way. But David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. And David therefore sent out spies, and understood that Saul was come in very deed," or as the New American Standard says it, that he was definitely coming. He says, is Saul out here? You know, he wasn't sure. Why is Saul out here in the wilderness again? I just saved his life not all that long ago. He said he'd never come again. Is he really coming after me again? And so he sends out spies to find out, and finds out that he is definitely coming after David. Verse 5, "And David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul..." And Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his host, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. By the way, some versions explain the trench. He said, what is he lying in a trench for? Man, if he gets a downpour, he's going to get wet. The trench was really, that's just King James, the trench was, it really was the encirclement of the camp. In other words, they would have placed Saul right in the middle, and they'd have circled the wagons just like they did with the Indians. You know, and there would have been 3,000 men. There would have been a perimeter of 3,000 men around what's in the King James called the trench, where they kept Saul, or tried to keep Saul safe. All right, now this time, catch this, that this time David wasn't about to wait for Saul to come to him, but instead he takes it to Saul himself. And I suspect he was probably emboldened to do so as a result of their previous counter, don't you think? What happened there? And so he's not waiting for Saul. He's taking it to Saul. Verses 6 through 8. It says, and then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? Now he's got, I think, 600 men with him, if I remember correctly. You know, who's going with me? How many of you going with me, right? No, he's not asking for all of his men to go down. He's looking for one volunteer. And Abishai said, I'll go down with thee. And so David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench. Now keep in mind what that means, and now picture what David and Abishai are doing, working from the outside perimeter of the camp all the way to the center, through all of these men. And his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him. Verse 8, and then said Abishai to David, God has delivered thine enemy. I don't think he's yelling at this time, unless he knew that God had put a deep sleep over them. But I think he's saying, then he says, God has delivered thine enemy into thy hand this day. Now therefore, let me smite him, and I pray thee with a spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him again a second time. Abishai had to have been thinking at this moment and before. He had to be thinking, surely this time, Saul is deserving to die. He was given his life the last time, and here he is all over again, unjustifiably hunting us down all over again in spite of what happened the last time. And why would David have brought me along if it wasn't for this purpose, if this isn't what he had in mind? Especially being that David is taking the battle to Saul rather than waiting for Saul to bring the battle to him. Abishai was surely thinking when he volunteered that he was volunteering for something that he would go down in history for. You know, the men who volunteered, and I'm sure there were many others, you know, there were probably the 30 mighty men all with him at that time, and he picks Abishai. They all had to be thinking, man, let me be the one, and I'll go down in history for doing it. Little did he know that he had simply volunteered to be an errand boy, to do manual labor. Verse 9, and David said to Abishai, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against Yahweh's anointed and be guiltless? Sound familiar? Two chapters earlier, maybe? Same song, same verse again from David. David no more intended to kill Saul this time than he had the previous time, because nothing in his mind had changed. In fact, maybe it had even been solidified after what happened with Nabal in the chapter before, that he wasn't about to take revenge again. And maybe that was also why God let happen with that, had David go through that lesson around Mount Sinai, so that when Saul showed up again, he would be again uninclined to take his life, take revenge into his own hands. Verse 10, continuing, and David said furthermore, as Yahweh liveth, Yahweh shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. David remained faithful, in other words, to God, trusting that he would deal with him as and when he desired to deal with him. Verse 11, and Yahweh forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against Yahweh's anointed, but I pray thee, take thou the spear that is in his bolster and the cruse of water, and let us go. Abishai, he expected to be carrying back the head of Saul to his comrades. And instead, he comes back carrying his spear and his cruse of water, his water jug. In other words, David wasn't the only one David wasn't the only one who needed to take another lap around Mount Sinai, was he? To learn what he needed to learn. Nevertheless, let's give credit where credit is due here. You know, talk about devotion and bravery. For whatever reason, Abishai thought he was volunteering for. You talk about devotion and bravery. When you start realizing again that he's got the two of them, that Abishai's got to guard David while working their way through 3,000 of Saul's best men to the center of the encampment. He deserves some praise for what he did, even if he had the wrong thing in mind. Question, we've done this before. Question, are we as willing to go wherever it is that our king would lead us? Against maybe what would otherwise appear to be insurmountable odds at times? If we're a man after the heart of Yahweh, then indeed we will. Verse 12, continuing with this account. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they gat them away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither awaked, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from Yahweh was fallen upon them. By the way, that deep sleep there, that same phrase is what is used, the same Hebrew phrase is what's used to describe Adam and the deep sleep he was in when Yahweh took the rib from him to form Eve. Verse 12, and God had caused these men to fall asleep, including Saul's bodyguard. And yet, don't you think that somebody's still in trouble? That somebody who is supposed to be guarding Saul, somebody's, maybe a whole lot of somebody's, are in trouble. Verse 13, and then David went over to the other side and stood on the top of the hill afar off, and a great space being between them. And I know you can read these words in a different fashion, but I'm going to read them, share with you how I think it kind of went. And David cried, verse 14, and David cried to the people and to Abner. Now, he doesn't call to Saul initially. He calls to Abner, his bodyguard. And he says, he calls to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, answereth not Abner? Abner! Oh, Abner! is how I think he was doing it. And then Abner answered and said, who art thou that criest to the king? And David said to Abner, art thou not a valiant man? And who is like thee in Israel? Abner, you guard of this king. I think David's having some fun with this. And wherefore then hast thou not kept the Lord the king? For there came one of the people in to destroy the king thy lord, Abner. This thing is not good, Abner, that thou hast done. As Yahweh liveth, you are worthy to die, because you have not kept your master, Yahweh's anointed. Oh, Abner, again, I think he's having fun with it. Let's continue with this. And now see where the king, for that latter part of verse 16. And now see, Abner, where the king's spear is. Look, Abner, you know where it was before. Where is it now, Abner? And where is the cruse of water that was at his bolster? And Saul knew David's voice and said, is this my voice, my son David? Oh, by the way, Abner didn't die. Probably because he was Saul's cousin. And I'm sure that probably David knew that. And he probably knew it was unlikely that Saul would kill him. And so he just had fun with the deal. He didn't die. But boy, you talk about humiliation in front of all your comrades, 3,000 other men whom you're supposed to be the best of the bunch. And you let somebody sneak in and take the spear right from his head when he could have driven it through his heart. My, oh, my. Continuing, verse 17, and Saul knew David's voice and said, is this thy voice, my son David? And David said, it is my voice, my lord, O my king. And he said, wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after his servant? Or what has he done? Or what evil is in my hand? Again, same words as before. Now, Therefore, I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If Yahweh, now listen to this, he says, if Yahweh have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. What is he talking about? David was talking about himself. He was talking about, if Yahweh sent you, I'll be the offering. Let me be the offering that Yahweh is obviously requiring. We read this last night in our family scriptures last night, and it literally jumped off the page for me. I've just been working on this message and this part of the message in Psalm 7. I believe that probably Psalm 7 was written at this time in David's life, verses 1 through 5. It says, O Yahweh, my God, in thee do I put my trust. Save me from all them that persecute me and deliver me, lest he tear my soul like a lion, rending it in pieces while there is none to deliver. Then listen particularly to verses 3 through 5. O Yahweh, my God, if I have done this, if there be iniquity in my hands, if I have rewarded evil unto him that was at peace with me, yea, I have delivered him that was without cause as my enemy. Verse 5, let the enemy persecute my soul and take it. Yea, let him tread down my life upon the earth and lay my honor in the dust. In other words, Saul, if it's Yahweh who sent you, let it be that I be killed, and that I be a sweet-smelling savor unto him. But, he says, picking it up with where we left off in 19, but if they be the children of men whom have sent you, cursed be they before Yahweh, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of Yahweh, saying, go serve other gods. Now therefore let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of Yahweh, for the king of Israel is come to seek a flea. And note that he doesn't even here begin with a dead dog. He just goes straight to comparing himself with a flea. Again, the same humility, saying, I'm an insignificant flea. Why would you come out here and follow after me? Verse continuing, verse 20. And as when one doth hunt a partridge in the mountains. Why do you come out here hunting a partridge? By the way, back at in earlier times then, they used to hunt partridges in such a way that they actually could take a stick and whack them over the head. They'd keep flushing them and flushing them and flushing them until the partridges could no longer fly. And so that's what he was saying. Why do you come out here and keep flushing me, doing this over and time again until some point in time I'm going to be so exhausted you'll be able to just gather me up in a butterfly net. Continuing, verse 21. And then said Saul, I have sinned. Return my son David. Here we go again. Why didn't he learn the lesson the first time? Then said Saul, I have sinned. Return my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, behold the king's spear, and let one of the young men come over and fetch it. He wouldn't even keep the spear. The very spear, by the way, that had probably been thrown two or three times at David himself and almost pinned him to the wall in the king's chambers. Verse 23, Yahweh rendered to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness, for Yahweh delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth my hand against Yahweh's anointed. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by the eyes of Yahweh, and let him deliver me out of all my tribulation. Note that David didn't simply claim what was his just reward in what he said, but he didn't even mention Saul's just reward this time. Trying to make it as possible as he could to conciliate and to be at peace with all men so much as it depended upon him that Saul would stop and would cease chasing him through the desert to kill him. Psalms 35, a psalm of David, very possibly written at this time as well. Verse 1, plead my cause, O Yahweh, with them that strive with me, fight against them that fight against me. He wouldn't take it in his own hands, so he says, Lord, you must be my defender. Verse 4, let them be confounded and put to shame that seek after my soul. Let them be turned back and brought to confusion that devise my hurt. Verse 7 through 8, for without cause have they hid for me their net in a pit, which without without cause they have digged for my soul. Let destruction come upon him unawares, and let his net that he has hid catch himself into that very destruction, let him fall. Verses 11 through 12, false witnesses did rise up and laid to my charge things that I knew not. They rewarded me evil for good and spoiling of my soul. Verse 19, let not them that are mine enemies wrongfully rejoice over me, neither let them wink with the eye that hate me without cause. Verse 23, stir up thyself and wake up. Wake to my judgment, even to my cause, O God, my Lord. Verse 26, let them be ashamed and brought to confusion together that rejoice in my hurt. Let them be clothed with shame and dishonor and magnify themselves against, who magnify themselves against me. And he ends with verse 28, and my tongue shall speak of thy righteousness and of thy praise all the day long. I believe that was probably written either back in chapter 24, during the incidents of chapter 24, or here in 26. And he is reiterating in Psalm what was on his heart as a result of the situation at hand. In verse 25, the chapter ends by saying, then Saul said to David, blessed be thou, my son, that thou shalt both do great things, and also that thou shalt prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned unto his place. Note, Saul returned home, but David remained a fugitive, not trusting that Saul was going to be any more true to his word this time than he had proven to be in the past. And in fact, in what must have been a weak moment of doubting Yahweh, David even despaired at this point that Saul would indeed eventually slay him. Look at chapter 27, verse 1. It says, and David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. And in fact, I believe that he probably would have. Because don't forget that although Yahweh's using all these trips around, quote unquote, Mount Sinai to train and prepare the future king, David was nonetheless in disobedience, at least as it appears that way. Because it would appear that, if you remember back in some of the earlier messages, that Yahweh had sent David to hide him amongst the Philistines when he initially fled from Saul. Remember the case? He goes to Achish, if you remember the previous message. But David, like Jonah, if this is correct, appears to have faltered in faith and trust in Yahweh and chose to do otherwise. Said, I'm better off in the wilderness flying from Saul. And so I think it's very possible in the fact that it appears that he was in a disobedience in that fashion, that had he remained out there, he would have indeed been slain by Saul. Well, after several years, finally, and there, I don't know how many, it was probably 3 to 7 years out there in the wilderness. After several years, several laps around, quote unquote, Mount Sinai, he finally figures it out. Better to do it Yahweh's way and to trust him and that he can deliver my soul than to do it my own way. And so his laps around Mount Sinai came to an end, and he's going back to where he had obviously been told to go in the first place. Look at verses 1 through 4. And David said into his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, right where I think God had told him to go in the first place. And Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel, so shall I escape out of his hand. And David arose, and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him, unto Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. And David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. And it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath, and he sought no more again for him. Hallelujah, we should say. And what we need to do is learn the lesson that David learned the hard way. It is better. Yahweh is faithful to his promises. He is faithful to deliver us no matter what. He can and he will save us. Has he not promised that? Even in the midst of our enemies. I don't know if you looked around you, but they're everywhere. We're there, like it or not. And he's able to deliver us. And furthermore, he can even use us there to build or further his kingdom as well. Look at 5 verses 5 through 10 of this chapter. And David said unto Achish, if I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there. For why should thy servant dwell in the royal city? Achish provides that to him. Verse 8. And David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gezerites and the Amalekites. For those nations were of old the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even unto the land of Egypt. Now these were obviously allies of the Philistines. And then verse 9, and David smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive, and took away the sheep and the oxen and the asses and the camels and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. Verse 10, and Achish said, whither have you made a raid? Whither have you made a road today? And David said, against the south of Judah. Doesn't sound like those he raided up above. And against the south of the Jerahmeelites, and against the south of the Kenites. Obviously, enemies of the Philistines. Now, I want to read you very quickly Adams Clark commentary on this portion of this chapter. He says, there is not one circumstance in this transaction that we just read about that is not blamable. David joins the enemies of his God and his country, and of his country, perpetrates a most inhuman act against the Geshurites and the Amalekites without even the presence of divine authority. How he knows that, I don't know. Tells a most deliberate falsehood to Achish, his protector, relative to the people against whom he had perpetrated this cruel act, giving him to understand that he had been destroying the Israelites, his enemies. I undertake no defense of this conduct of David. It is all bad, all defenseless. God does not vindicate David. Well, we don't know that either, do we? Can't speak where the Bible doesn't speak. The inspired penman tells what he did, but passes no eulogium upon his conduct, and it is false to say that because these things are recorded, therefore they are approved. In all of these transactions, David was in no sense a man after God's own heart. I beg to differ, because we have already seen this to be untrue. Shiphrah and Puah, who lied to the Pharaoh and were blessed by God. Samuel, who was told to lie in order to save a life. Told by Yahweh to lie. And therefore, Adam Clark's commentary on this just doesn't stand to reason. He was a man after Yahweh's heart. This is but another righteous lie to do what? Righteous lies. There's only one case where lies are righteous before God, and that's to save he and his men's lives. And it also was a cover for his work in expanding the kingdom of God. All right, let's finish this chapter. And David saved neither man, verse 11, I'm sorry. And David saved neither man nor woman alive to bring things to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David, and so will be his manner all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines. Verse 12, and Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly to abhor him, and therefore he shall be my servant forever. Safety, protection, in the middle of enemies. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 17 promises us that when a man's way are pleasing to Yahweh, he will make even his enemies to be at peace with him. I've witnessed it. I've shared it with you in the past very quickly. At the time when we were the newspapers had the front page headline news was the lies about me in this ministry by Morris Dees. You know, there could have been many could have turned enemy in this country or in this area who, to my knowledge, never have. But beyond that, there was one particular man down there with all the racist lies that were said about me. There was a man down at the post office that I often did business with who was a Mexican, Ralph. And I had prayed that morning when I took the tapes in, that was the response to those articles, that I'd get Ralph. And there were three or four clerks there, and I could have gotten anyone, and God allowed me to have Ralph. And he said, "What? How was your weekend, Ted?" And I said, "I've had better." And he said, "I'd think so." And I said, here's the tape. Here's a message that I preached in response to that, and it's the other side of the story. He never treated me any differently. He wasn't an enemy, but he had the potential of being an enemy. And God made him at peace with me. And not only that, God turned it around to where he often comes to me with prayer requests. God is indeed true to his word. Not because of that experience or that witness from me, but simply because he says so. He is able to deliver us, to provide us salvation, to protect and keep us, to prosper us, even amongst his enemies. In fact, we're not told this, but I am convinced that probably Psalms 23, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that Psalms 23 was written at this time in David's life. Let me read it to you. Let me add this. After David had learned his lesson and had trusted Yahweh and found a banquet in his honor, even amongst his enemies. Psalms 23, verses 1 through 4, and we're done. Yahweh is my shepherd, and I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his namesake. Catch this next part. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. How many times have you said that? Note, he's not being buried in the valley of the shadow of death, as is so often used in funerals. He's living, walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Verses 4 and 6. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Verse 5. Thou dost prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou hast anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. As I've said before, he's complaining for a bigger cup, even in the midst of his enemies. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all of my days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of Yahweh forever. Puts a new light to that psalm, doesn't it? If indeed that's where David was somewhere amongst his enemies when he wrote that psalm, and I suspect it was there in the land of the Philistines under King Achish's protection, instead of being threatened to be put to death. Hallelujah. Praise our God. Amen. Praise our God for his goodness and his mercies and his everlasting protection, his covering that he has put us under if we belong to him. Let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you, Lord, for your word again, for these promises and for the life of David that provides an example for us of how to be men and women with hearts like yours. Help us to learn the lessons. Help us to apply them for our sake, but Father, more importantly, that we might live our lives in such a way to glorify you. Praise be unto thee now. We glorify you in Yeshua the Christ. Amen. And we're dismissed.